Hello, I'm Amy Dale and welcome to Just Chat, the podcast where we talk with those making and shaping the law. No bias, no politics, just chat. The story of 2020 will not just be the tale of the coronavirus pandemic. It will also record an important chapter, a global reckoning with the treatment of Black people within the justice system. Whether it's first Australians or those more recently arrived on our shores, persons of colour face a multitude of barriers in accessing justice. They are typically disproportionately represented in our courts and jails, and as victims, they often face a much harder path to achieving justice and finalisation. Lawyers of colour can be a powerful conduit between their community and the courts. They bring to the profession a unique understanding of the challenges, from translation concerns to systemic racism and harmful stereotypes that are faced by vulnerable communities. Yet they are also a powerful representation to their communities that the system is starting to hear them. Conversations around racism and barriers to justice in the profession might be uncomfortable, but they are deeply necessary if we are ever to create a system that is truly colourblind. Zahir Edries and Sara Khan are the founder and current president of the Muslim Legal Network New South Wales. They became lawyers just over a decade ago in the shadow of counter-terror legislation that disproportionately targeted their community. They themselves had to confront hurtful stereotypes and standing out simply for being who they are. Both are now thriving in their current legal roles, yet continue to work on nurturing the ties between their community and the criminal justice system. Zahir and Sara kindly sat down with me recently. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Well, Sara and Zahir, thank you so much for joining us. It's wonderful to have the opportunity to speak with you both. What I might do is talk a little bit about how both of you came to have a career in the law. So, Sara, I might just start with you and talk about, did you always want to be a lawyer?
Fell into criminal law, loved it, and continued down that path.
What is it about the criminal law that you love?
I guess people and the diversity, and every day is different. So it's very challenging and keeps you on your toes, yeah.
And Zahir, tell me a little bit about your journey into being a lawyer.
My eventual career as a lawyer makes a lot of sense in hindsight, but it didn't at the time. And I say that because my parents sort of have, mum has a background in studying law, and social justice was sort of really important in our family, given where I was born and growing up in South Africa. But I actually left school and did engineering first because, you know, every good ethnic kid either becomes a doctor or an engineer and lawyer somewhere down the bottom of the line. So I disappointed my family by switching to law. But no, it was, I think I sort of, for me, it was sort of post 9/11 at uni. That era was pretty formative for me and a lot of my close friends. So it was a interesting turning point in my academic career. And then I did law postgrad. So I sort of never really knew exactly what type of law I wanted. Like Sara, falling into an area, I sort of fell into litigation. So, which worked really well for me. I have done various types of litigation, employment, you know, civil, generalist, insurance, as every good junior lawyer does, a whole bunch of insurance law if you're a litigator. And that now I found myself doing sort of electoral law, which is really interesting and something I would never have thought that 15 years ago I would be doing now. But it's a, you know, really interesting space. I do a fair bit of admin and electoral law. So I think, you know, did I see myself doing this when I first went into law school? No. Do I love it still? Yeah, of course.
Maybe this is also a good opportunity to talk about what did it feel like when you were first at law school?
I actually did both degrees from two different universities. I enjoyed studying law, actually, and enjoyed the different dynamic and being in the city. Enjoyed it. It was close to work as well, so I worked throughout my law degree and I felt that that was quite important. I actually enjoyed it. The people, the lecturers, the choice of subjects, and just having that mix of practical law, I guess.
Zahir, what was it like for you?
Yeah, it's testing my memory a bit. I probably wouldn't have enjoyed doing law as an undergrad as much as I did as a postgrad. I don't know if you feel the same.
Yeah, I think
way.
I'm the same.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting, and when I look at my colleagues who were either postgrad like me or the ones that came straight out of school, we had a very different experience in how we engaged in law school. So, like, did we engage in all of the social things? Probably some of them, but not as many. But I think I probably studied a little bit more and paid a little bit more attention. I always thought it was really good. I had a really good experience at UTS. It was one of the few universities that offered nighttime classes. So, you know, I came to Sydney to study, and for me it was, you know, Sydney's not the cheapest city in the world, so you got to work and study at the same time. So I think, yeah, university was good for me. It was fun. I look back at it now and I think I do miss it and enjoy it.
It seems interesting as well when you talk about sort of having a lot of enjoyment doing it as a postgraduate, but it also sounds like there's more of an opportunity to have a broader diversity of people from all backgrounds rather than the undergrad experience, which probably seems to maybe attract more who are able to study full-time, perhaps don't have to work, and also people who've had other careers beforehand and then sort of have made more of a concerted effort to go into the law. Do you think that it's an important pathway to broaden the diversity of people going into the profession, is to have more and more people who come to it as a second degree or a second career?
I would say not necessarily. I had a pretty diverse group of friends even in my undergrad. I would say not necessarily, although I'm sure it would assist, because your mindset and how you perceive your work, I guess, and your clients and just see the world, I guess it would help in that sense. But that could be in any time in your life, I guess, and what experiences you've had and what exposure you've had, whether it's to the world or to people or culture. I would say not necessarily for me.
Yeah, I'm kind of in two minds about mine, because I think in a lot of similar ways I'm with Sarah on that. But one of the interesting things that I found was also just the change of university scene. So, I've said it before, you know, UTS is quite an eclectic group of people there. They got a lot of international students. And also the makeup of the law was very different. Of the law students was very different. I think when I my undergrad was in legal studies in Western Australia in Perth, and at Murdoch University, I was there with a lot of, you know, first year law students and first year legal studies students, and they were of a particular group and dynamic of people. You know, they were certain people who studied law who came from certain schools, and whereas UTS postgrad, there is a difference. There is a mix of people. You are exposed to a little bit of difference, but I think as a postgrad student, you experience things differently as well. So maybe I looked for a little bit more, or I experienced it differently. But it was a really interesting dynamic. The change between the universities was actually quite different. Like now I know that they've got quite a few programs talking about how to get people into their, not a free advertisement for UTS, but I think it's quite good, how to get students who wouldn't ordinarily want to study law into these programs. And I think that's a really good way of looking at my experience, sort of was going towards that. And it's really good to see that that's occurring now.
I think as well, when we studied, you had to do a double degree, whereas now you can do a straight law degree, as I understand. So you probably didn't have that that extra burden, I guess, in some ways, or it wasn't a necessity, whereas you have more options.
Postgrad students with families or other obligations would find it really difficult to go to UCID. You know, 15 years ago, it's changed now, but we'd find it really difficult, whereas universities that offer different modes of engagement tend to attract different types of people and a bigger cohort of diversity, I think, generally across the board.
When you moved into your graduate roles, how did you find that? And do you think that your experience then is different to how a graduate going into, say, a big law firm would feel now? Maybe, Sarah, I'll start with you.
So I did apply for the big law firms, as I think most people do when you're at university. It's a big thing. I did not get any offers. However, I was working for a senior barrister at the time, who's now a judge, and I actually went down the path of applying for a tip staff position in the Supreme Court. So I knew that that role was available to myself because they do early acceptance as well. So I went down that path. So it was a little bit different, probably not as challenging academically as a grad role would be. And I think when you're used to constantly studying and it's a little bit different. So the pace is a little bit slower in terms of learning, but practicality, it's fast paced because there's a lot of shoes to fill and a lot of expectations and you're in court. So I think that my path was slightly different, rewarding in the sense that the things I learnt and absorbed at my time at the courts is definitely something that you take for granted while you're there, but in practicality, if you're an advocate, definitely useful. So little things, nuances that you learn, relationships you build with judges and their staff still assist to this day.
How did you feel when you were in that role the first time that you were in a courtroom?
I had a little bit of experience in a courtroom because working with a barrister, we were doing a lot of trials, so I was constantly there. So I had that exposure. And then while I was a student, I just out of interest used to go watch trials. So I had that exposure in that sense, and that wasn't daunting. But obviously being on the other side where you're sitting next to a judge on the bench, definitely can't fall asleep. And yet, different in that sense, but not daunting in the sense of being in a courtroom. However, that I don't think it's ever less daunting for you to appear as an advocate in everyday life. You still have your jitters and your nerves, and I think that's pretty normal. So,
do you still get that today?
100%.
I think for me it was doubly interesting because I graduated right around the GFC. So it was quite confronting. I mean, I was thinking about this on my way here, and I remember one of the big four accounting firms had cut their graduate intake by 80%. They only took 5 people instead of 40 or something crazy like that. And all of my colleagues, we all just looked at each other and said, how are we going to get in? I took a job. I was at a top tier firm while I was studying, and then I sort of went into a national mid tier as a quote unquote graduate because they canned the graduate program. it wasn't officially there, but I was lucky. It was a really interesting experience, I think. Being in a firm like that where you had previously not been exposed significantly to the inner workings of large corporates can be super confronting, right? It can be daunting if you don't come from a family that has that. You don't have context for it. So that's, I think, a really interesting thing that a lot of people don't necessarily turn their mind to when they're becoming graduates is, what am I going to expect? And I had a really good experience, but I know that it was mixed because you get your good partners and your difficult senior associates and all of those sorts of dynamics play out. And those are the things I think you don't necessarily hear before you become a lawyer, because I remember going to these information sessions that all the big firms put on, and they tell you about all of the great things they do, and we've got this huge, I'm a giant, bleeding heart when it comes to certain things. So they're like, we've got this big pro bono program and we've got all of these things that you can do, and you get there and they're like, yeah, you can do all this work once you've billed 7.5 hours a day, once you've met all of these targets. And so, you've worked a 50-hour week and you're like, great, now I get to go work on stolen wages work, which is really important, but you're drained and difficult. And, those sorts of dynamics are hard to deal with in someone in your, mid-20s. It's challenging. I enjoyed it, but it was challenging.
How at that time, and I suppose it's also relevant as to how you find it now, how did you feel confronting the homogenous nature of the profession?
Look, I think I've spoken about this before, and I found it quite interesting. Even before I was a graduate, I was noticeably, in a lot of ways, the odd one out. So I'm a person of colour. I have a very Arab name. I'm also identify as Muslim, I'm practicing Muslim. So all of those sorts of things, I think, play a part in how you're perceived by the people you work with, which is may not change how you interact professionally, but it most definitely changed. Let's hope it's not changes, but changed sort of when I was admitted many years ago, the way people around me interacted with me. So that's a very, like, it's a very strange feeling. I think I've told you this before, Amy, that I hadn't, this one particular top tier firm I was at, I think three of the summer clerks' parents were judges. That's an extraordinary thing to have as a, not quite a trump card, but as a leg up almost. So they not only had the experience and the connection, but they understood how the system worked. So I didn't know. I was different, didn't go to their schools, you know, didn't roll in the same circles. So it's very funny because you don't, it takes a long time for someone who, I guess, is very aware of their identity like me to feel like you fit into the profession, like you've got to work your way into making this your patch. And that's, you know, that's me, someone who sounds like I do. I mean, listeners would probably be like, he's got a very thick Aussie accent. And I do. I've been here, you know, the majority of my life. But yeah, you know, those little identifiers, and we talk about it today in today's terms about, we talk about unconscious bias. We, you know, we implement lovely things like blind interviews, and we review resumes now without names on them. And we, some of the big firms have taken out the universities that they went to, because that was a thing when I graduated. UTS was a bit, people were like, oh, that wasn't that a, I remember our partner saying to me one day, oh, they do law there now. I laughed a bit because it was like, it was a joke, but he said, oh, that used to be a technical college. I did my teaching degree there. Like that, and that's sort of like, it's tongue in cheek, but that's the perception that you get, you know, depending on what you look like or where you went. And I know, like, I mean, for Sarah, she, you know, someone who is visibly carries their faith on them by wearing a headscarf or dressing a particular way, I think you have different experiences, right?
Yeah. I think for me, I wore the headscarf during my undergrad, and it was an informed decision I made. It was after September 11. There was many other women that were in the public face who had either taken it off or had put it on. So when I made the decision, obviously I thought about what am I going to have to face, and am I ready to face society, I guess, and the questions. So for me, entering the law, I was very conscious of it. And probably not, I shouldn't have to be. In an ideal world, no one should have to be conscious of their appearance and the decisions of their beliefs and things like that. But I was very conscious of it. And so I think in some ways I was ready to tackle it. I knew I wouldn't be perceived the same as everybody else. And I did experience that. In fact, I had someone interview me for a job. They were definitely keen to have a solicitor. And they told me during the interview, sorry, you don't fit my clientele or the area where I operate my business. And I wasn't offended by it. I was actually, and maybe I should have been offended, but I wasn't. I was glad that he was open and honest, because for me, I wouldn't want to work for someone that wasn't comfortable or even supportive, I guess, of that fact. So he was open and honest, and I took it as a positive. If I share that story with anyone else, they think, oh my God. But that's the reality, and that's what we live in. So 100%, I think there's a lot of obstacles, and to be visibly different is a big obstacle. And I think networking, putting yourself out there, you got to do it. You just do. And hopefully someone will see you for who you are and the work you and the effort you put in, and you know, go from there. But I think definitely that's a big thing. As Zahir mentioned, your name. There's so many people in the profession who have anglicised their names because it's a hurdle. Where you live. I've been in interviews. I've been in the like in the group where you're looking at resumes, and you know, people at the top of your firms and employers, they're actually saying, oh, that person lives at that suburb. No, we're not going to hire him. Unfortunately, it's the truth. I live out west, and I used to travel more than an hour to come into work, and I always would use that example. Why does where someone live have any impact on why they should get a job? If they're willing to come, then what's – I never took a sickie. So if you're committed, you're going to know from your employee, but their suburb shouldn't matter. But that's, you know, something that employers do look at. How you look on paper is very different to the physical appearance. As Zahir said, how you sound is very different to when you meet someone face to face, and people's perceptions and attitudes do change, unfortunately. And it's just about getting that first opportunity, I guess. In the courts, I was amazed at the flexibility and the respect I got at the courts. I was the only scarfed individual, the only Muslim at the time. There was another Muslim and actually one of our colleagues who went through the courts, and a few of the judges knew them. They used to say, oh, I've never met a Muslim before. And I used to laugh because I used to say, the guy down at the cafe where you buy your coffee, he's actually a Muslim. You might not know that, but he is. So I don't think it's, you might not fit a stereotype, or you just got to think outside the box. And I think that's something that we lack, whether it's in our profession or just generally in society.
I think it's interesting, if I just could pick up one quick thing that Sarah mentioned, that, you know, she never took a sick day. And I think that's really emblematic of how people of colour, people who are in a minority, feel they have to work to prove themselves. Like, if we want to talk about, you know, how do we confront it? You know, there's this, I have a colleague who always has this joke, and she says, Zahir, you know, you spent your whole life working at overcapacity just to meet the expectations of society because you are always behind the eight ball. Now, that's not, I don't think that's taking a defeatist approach. I think that's a very practical way of looking at things, and that's a really good example of how, when you are, you know, all of the things that Sarah and I said, you know, we acknowledge people make these assumptions about us when they see us, but we've fallen into this habit, good or bad, of having to almost prove why we are worthy of this station or being part of this, you know, legal community. And it's like the first step is prove that you're better than the next person, because you're going to be measured to a different standard. The goalposts are always moving, right? So the measurement is different, which I think is a really interesting thing when we're thinking about what did we see, because we graduated around the same time and entered the workforce around the same time. I think what did we see and what we experienced is very different to what our, you know, let's say our white colleagues didn't go through this sort of stuff, regardless of whether or not they had the same marks or similar experiences going through law school. So it's a very interesting perspective. I think it's gotten better, but I think it could be
way better. I think it's super slow. In the last 10 years, I think, and it might lead into your next question, Amy, but I think in the last 10 years it's been a very slow change. I think even looking at our colleagues, I think people of colour wear their beliefs and their backgrounds a little bit more proudly now. I think before, we know even through our work in the Muslim Legal Network, where we've met a lot of other Muslims, and through them we've known, oh, so-and-so is actually a barrister. Do you know that? And they actually are from the Islamic faith. No, we didn't know a lot of people were. And I think it's because no one wore it proudly. People used to hide the fact that they were different. And I think it's just like a lot of women at the bar. They were not treated as equal, and they're still not treated as equal. And it's unfortunate, but it's a reality that we have to face and we have to address. And I think through our work, and maybe generally through more individuals being more confident and putting themselves out there, and also their colleagues respecting them and giving them a leg up, or giving them the opportunity to face the public, and giving them more speaking roles, I think it gives other people a bit of comfort and encouragement to, you know, be yourself and own up and be an individual. Like, there's nothing wrong with it. So
I do want to turn now to talking about the Muslim Legal Network and how it came to be. But I just first wanted to ask you both, because listening to you both, you both talk about your experiences with an extraordinary amount of grace and humour in a way. And I'm sort of amazed at your words. And is there ever a moment where you have gotten angry about it?
Daily. Like, daily. Like, I don't say that with malice, but there's a frustration when you know you have done nothing but exist to cause this reaction to you. It's debilitating sometimes, right? Like, it's really difficult. So you push it to the back of your mind. You do, but when I say daily, like, you do think about it, because, like, you've got to be in, like, this is a personal reflection. I've got to be on my best behavior every moment of the day, because the reaction is never you are having a bad day. It's you are having you, the insert descriptor, 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 negative, negative connotation, are having a bad day, right? Whereas my colleague who doesn't have those negative descriptors just has a bad day. So it's a frustration about, you know, and it's like, you know, we make it into our profession, and we make it into this station. And I've been very fortunate, and I'm very lucky in a lot of ways to be where I am, I think. And I've had some really good mentors, but you get to a particular station and it's like, if you don't, even when you get there, if you don't toe the line, you could lose it for something ridiculous. And that sort of existent paranoia is just, it lives in your brain and it's hard to shut down. Like, it's difficult to put away. So yeah, you get angry. Occasionally it results in, you know, bad interactions with people. But I think for the most part, and maybe this is a testament to our training, we get taught to suppress the emotion and analyze what the actual issues are. So that's like a good and a bad thing, right? So you're like, is this really about me, or is this about this other person? So you tend to become quite reflective about things going on around you that impact you. But yeah, I don't, like, that's me. I don't know if Sarah, do you feel the same in some ways or different?
I think I'll just just on one point that you just raised, I think you're taught to suppress the emotion but also to counter it with a positive emotion. So I think that always resonates, and I think because I wear a scarf and I'm physically telling people I'm Muslim, I feel like at times, you probably should be on your good behavior all the time, but at times you consciously think, oh, if I react in a very negative way, they're going to think that stereotypical Muslims are so-and-so. So I think I always try and remember that not to, doesn't mean I don't react inside. Oh, yeah, I'm burning. I'm firing away. And you probably do share it with a colleague or your family or friends. But, yeah, I don't think I haven't had to, I can – yeah, I can hands down say I haven't had anyone on the bench ever treat me differently. I don't think so anyway. And if I have, within a few seconds, it has changed. Their demeanour has changed. So I don't think who I am or how I'm perceived has ever affected the way I advocate. Amongst colleagues, yes, you do get sometimes singled out or you get ignored. And that's not to say that it's only from someone that's non-brown or non-coloured. I can say that I've been ignored by my own brethren, males normally, where you're standing in a group, and it happened to me recently and I was really annoyed. I was like, that person knows me and I'm standing right there and they're ignoring me. Mm-hmm. Why? And I think it's just that whole male-female dynamic, or maybe they didn't realise, I don't know, but... you get it,
it's
female and, yeah.
I wanted to talk about how the Muslim Legal Network came to be. So, Zihi, I'll start with you and want to turn to Sarah to talk about how the Muslim Legal Network is going now.
Yeah, I think how did it begin? So I think the more I tell this story, the flowerier it gets, right? But the standard, the joke is that the main... I guess the founder of, if we want to say the founder, the brains behind the Muslim Legal Network is a barrister named Zaid Khan, and he hates me talking about it, so I'll just leave it at that.
He's even more humble.
He's the most humble man you'll ever meet. But he saw it initially as an opportunity, and I think we touched on this earlier about not finding your place in the law. And initially the Muslim Legal Network existed because in New South Wales it existed as a support network. So... Zaid and one of the former VPs and one of the original members, Rabia Khan, who's based in
Melbourne,
Victoria, now she's at the bar. She tells this joke, so I shouldn't say it's mine. She tells this joke that her and Zaid were standing in the courtroom one day and they sort of looked at each other, both doing crime, both sort of early graduates, and they sort of heard their names being referenced, and they were like, oh, there's a Khan. Oh, there's another Khan. Now, there's this running joke, like the Khan name is like a bit of a Smith name. It's everywhere in, I guess, the South Asian community. But it formed a connection. So, you know, Zayd and Rabia spoke to each other, and I think around the same time he reached out to me and a bunch of other lawyers, and it would have been around 2008, 2009 when we first started having this conversation. And it was literally a network of, for want of a better description, you know, some brown Muslim lawyers who didn't really quite know where they fitted. And we just wanted to provide a bit of peer support.
Meetings in the library or in someone's lounge room?
Meetings in the library, in Aziz's lounge room for the first little bit, you know, meetings wherever we could. We ended up finding out, like Sarah said before, that there were actually a bunch of other more senior Muslim lawyers in the profession. We just didn't know them for a number of different reasons. They were either, you know, not necessarily outward about their faith, or didn't you know, they might have anglicized their names, or they've been here for generations and we just, you know,
different probably, social groups.
Yeah, different social groups, different generation even. Yeah, so we I guess that's how we started. And then we realized there was a need for you know, education in the community. Our community was starved for information that was relevant for them. Really simple things. I remember one of the first things we ever organized was it was around the coroner's court and understanding postmortems, and, you know, in the Islamic faith, when someone passes, you should bury them and provide those burial rites as quickly as possible. So we spoke with a few lecturers, we spoke with a few experts, and we just had like a community discussion. And, you know, these are the things people want to know about, and what are the rules around it? How do you release a body? You know, what if there's an autopsy? How do you apply to the coroner's court? All of those different things were really important and integral. And I think fast forward a few years, we were then working on, you know, legislation that impacted the community, be it religious vilification laws, or unfortunately the vast swathes of counterterrorism legislation that this, I guess, disproportionately impacted young Muslim men. And we ended up doing a fair bit of advocacy work in the work on law reform work. So it's funny, this little organization that started out as sort of 10 friends wanting to chat, and you know, we're all still friends, into a bigger educative body that now does sort of a bit of legal interpretation for the community, representative of certain things, and provides an opportunity for, you know, the over 100 Muslim lawyers we know of, at least in the state, to have a level of identity that is attached to their faith but also attached to the profession that they want. And I think we fill that tiny little gap, I guess, a bit of that gap in that identity. So I mean, that's sort of where we've come, and now we're in the very capable hands of our current president, Sarah.
Don't know about that. So going from what Zahira said, I think one of the gaps were or something that we found that has taken up a little bit more interest is students. There are a lot out there that are Muslims or come from Islamic backgrounds and want to know what the Muslim Legal Network is about, or just don't have that support, or don't know where to go after uni or during uni, thinking about their future. So we actually started a mentoring program, and I think it's a second or third time running. Really interesting, actually. We had probably more mentees and mentors this time. But very interesting to hear the struggles that they're having, some which have never changed. I think Zahir mentioned earlier about what uni you went to, and that gets judged, still an issue. In fact, I think the university's board also had a similar topic come up, or a complaint, that a lot of students are finding that they're being discriminated in the top end when they're applying for grad roles. And that is still occurring. And I think a lot of the Western universities are trying to change that dynamic and change the perspective and have more employers come to their universities and talk and meet whatever gap there is. Because I don't think really there's anything lacking in their education. it's probably stereotypes. I don't know if there is something that employers are seeing and we just don't know about it. The advocacy with writing submissions for new laws that are coming through, I think we still have to work a little bit on that, where, and not even necessarily with the Muslim Legal Network, I think generally as a community, being aware of your rights and speaking out about your ideas and your beliefs and just the basic human rights. Pauline Wright, who's the president of the Law Council, she's been doing an amazing job where she's speaking a lot about human rights and civil liberties and silencing members of the community. So she's been a very good advocate, I would say, and I think more people need to get up and speak out. What else are we doing? So we've got the annual Ramadan dinner, which is every year during the month of Ramadan. We hold a dinner for members of our profession. It's a nice way to join in breaking of the fast at the end of the day, sharing in our faith as well, a bit of spirituality, and also a communal dinner as well. And
yeah, I think it's one of those rare opportunities that the legal profession gets to sit down, see something a little bit different, because funnily enough, probably 50% of our guests are not Muslim at this
dinner. More than 50.
Maybe even more. Last year it was even more. It just gets bigger and bigger. And I think they're really important. They've shown that we have an existence here. We're not, you know, I have this joke with our team. We always say we're not the poor cousins of the legal fraternity anymore. And I don't think we ever were, but, you know, we have this, I guess there's, you know, the perception that we're small, and that's fine. And I think that's warranted. But what we also have is well known for our hospitality. And I think that's something that really drives good relationships through the community, through the legal community, through our community, and through the broader community. I think it's really important. I mean, those are two very large events, you know, and if we were to add on, I guess, more of the community style events, and it's interesting in COVID times, we've had to adapt, and Sarah hosted, I guess, a Q&A session with the Governor, Her Excellency, Margaret Beasley, and Mr. Wilson just recently, and that was a really interesting way of engaging our members on a different topic with different types of speakers and in a completely different format. And I think, you know, we're working towards doing something like that now, and we're organising, hopefully, to have more of these. You know, we've got Facebook Live things happening, and I think that's, you know, you've got to communicate where your members are and how they see it and in the circumstances we're in at the moment.
I think everyone's learned to adapt, and it's been nice that everyone's on board and adjusting and just thinking outside the box, which I think everyone's doing all over the world, really. So it's been nice. We have to acknowledge that as we get bigger or progress in any group or as an organisation and as a group of individuals, it's important to acknowledge that we've had that support. So as many of the negative things that we experience in our day-to-day lives or profession in our careers, I think we're also appreciative of the people that also support us and join forces in a way as well and encourage us to do the work that we can do and give us hope that, you know, not everybody is homogenous and not everybody is the same, and there's a lot of good people out there who want to do this similar type of work. So it is important, and I think with the opening of law term as well,
I think that's really encouraging for this little organisation that started out, like, you know, we joke as almost a coffee club, has turned into an organisation that's really supportive and well supported.
And the chief justices of each court, Chief Justice Allsop, Chief Justice Bathurst and Price, and Justice Ainslie Wallace, they've all been amazing, like, throughout, and they try and attend as many events as they can and encourage their peers, which is, I think, important. And that's where you sort of start to break that dynamic and break those barriers, which is important.
You've both touched on it a little bit, so I'll pick up this point about the opening of law term dinner and the opening of law term service that I think you said it was in 2012. Was that when the first one was held? So maybe to talk me through a little bit about how that came to be, the idea and the initial reception to it.
I guess for context, Justin Dowd was has a very close relationship with a gentleman by the name of Haysom Farachi. We call him Sheikh Haysom because he's a practicing solicitor in the family law. He runs a firm mainly to do with family, and he used to work with Justin many years ago. And Sheikh Haysom,
who's joke that he's a surfing sheikh.
Yeah, he's the surfing sheikh. You can Google him. There's a couple of stories out there around him. He's a very interesting character and a bit of a mentor to all of us. He actually approached him and Zayed, the president at the time, sort of said, you know, this would be a really great way of bringing your organization in almost into the fold and understanding, and is this something you could do for the community? So I think there were a lot of different things, and it was primarily, I think it was, you know, primarily pushed by Justin and Sheikh Haysom at the time and Zayed. And how it came about was we sort of approached, we cheated a little bit. We found the prettiest mosque in Sydney, which is Auburn Gallipoli Mosque, and we said to them, you've got the facilities to be able to do this. Can we hold this event there? And, you know, in our faith, there aren't really, we don't have mass. We sort of have a Friday sermon and that's it. So what we did and what we thought was going to be a really lovely thing to do was to invite people to this mosque and just experience what it's like to be in a mosque. We got a couple of speakers. I think for the first year, the initial year, the chief justice at the time, he gave an address, and a few others. It sort of evolved into, I guess, a little bit more of a spiritual event. And, you know, like the other commencement services, it's designed to provide that, I guess you could say, a religious context or blessing to the start of the year, which is if you go to, you know, the Red Mass, that's sort of what happens there, except, you know, ours is very similar, just without the Mass. So we'll often have a speaker come in, whether they be a local scholar or we've had people from interstate speak on a particular topic and invite members of the judiciary, the broader community actually, and this is really important about this event, it's open to anyone. Anyone who registers with us can come and they can have a look. And for a lot of people and a lot of, you know, attorneys general have come and first time they've ever been to a mosque. That's why I joke and said it's cheating because you walk into this beautiful mosque with this gorgeous architecture in Auburn. But it's a really important event, particularly when it first started, because many judges just had never had experience with Muslims, and that was really important to make the connection between the people they were serving justice for and the people who are seeking out the justice is really important to make that connection.
And I think as well, traveling out west, so for those, Auburn Gallipoli Mosque, as its name says, it's out west, so it was a big trek and it was an eye-opener for some people. And it was an effort for peak hour traffic. That was, yeah, I think, one of the big things. So you had a lot of members of the profession and community leaving work early and coming out west, and normally it's quite hot in February as well. Mm. It is a big event, but it's a very spiritual and humbling event, I think. Both the community and members of our profession do look forward to it, and it's nice to be recognised as well, I think, as a faith in Australia who's... And we attend quite a few of the other religious opening of law terms as well, and it's just nice to be amongst your people and share in something similar. And
yeah, I think we can't overstate the importance of the connection that's made at events like this. If you are a religious or non-religious person, or in fact an atheist, I think why these events are important and why this was important is this has been occurring, you know, at the Red Mass, and I think the service at the synagogue has been happening for well over 70 years. This is only the seventh or the eighth year that it's happened in Australia from an Islamic perspective, and Muslims have been in this country for over 140 years. So I think there's significance there for us as a community to not look for acceptance, but receive the acknowledgement. And I think that's really important because it helps that sense of identity and belonging that we are, as a subset of the community, part of the greater, bigger community. And that's really important. And I think that this event actually plays a really integral part in that.
And is there also a sense of healing with it, given the often very hurtful and very damaging rhetoric that is thrown around when talking about different laws and different forms of legislation? I imagine then for the community, it's also a very significant moment to have the judiciary come and learn more about the Muslim faith.
I would definitely agree. And I think apart from the formalities of the proceedings, after the proceedings, we always have food, so finger food, and it's probably one of the highlights of the evening. But
we'd like to think they come for us, but I think they come for the food. But that's okay.
I think one of the things that we find is important, and I think everybody enjoys as well, it's the networking or the engaging, that the engagement that happens after the formalities, and that's when everyone's standing in the courtyard and talking to each other, approaching one another. So for individuals of the community and people of the profession who have never ever spoken to a judge or the president of the Law Society or the president of the New South Wales Bar or a priest or an imam, who have never able to approach someone in everyday life, are able to approach them and have a chat. And I think on both sides it breaks down those barriers. And both individuals are able to see the other for who they are and also get a bit of an insight on the type of work they do and breaking down those stereotypes. So I remember quite a few members of the profession who wouldn't ordinarily meet another Muslim actually said, oh, hey, that person's doing really amazing things in the community, or that person is an engineer, or they're a lawyer, or they're an expert at this, or they run a shop and I go to that shop and I buy my sweets from there. Like, just little things, and it's having those familiarities and just those, that common ground. And I think that's really important for these events and just generally, I think. Zahir?
Yeah, I think that's super important. I mean, I think we live in a balance of wanting to prove our humanity and just also be accepted generally. And I think this is one of those events where, at the risk of being too academic, I think there are power shifts in how people behave and where they go to. This is bringing the judicial community and the legal community onto into a place where the Muslim community feels comfortable. And I think that's really important, right? So we've got people coming to you, and that we like to facilitate that, because I think that's really a great way of knowing that the judiciary, and I said that a few times, I shouldn't just say the judiciary, but the legal fraternity cares about you, and you are not just a reference point. You are not just a byline. You're not just a 15-second grab, and you're not just a defendant. I mean, I told Sarah and the team this the first year we had this, a district court judge said to me, this is the first time I've met a Muslim that's not in the dock. And that's a really difficult thing to have said to you, but he said it in a very genuine way, like this was important for him to be there. And I mean, he was very brave to share that with me. To think how many other magistrates or judges may have been in a similar situation, I think that in and of itself is worth the 8 years we've been doing it, just that one conversation.
I think I was once asked actually in an interview by a judge, that if I took on the tip staff position, would I be able to act impartially if I had another Muslim appear before us?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, look, I think this particular event is really important for a number of different reasons, but I think it's shown its value over the years in many different ways. And I think now the fact that we continue to attract different people and new people and, you know, people who have said to me they never in their million years thought they would come to a mosque, but they've been every year for the last 5 years, once a year, because they like to see us and they want to know that everything is well in our community. And I think that's a real genuine, that comes from a place of genuine care, whereas not that there was no care before, is that there was no reason to care. So hopefully these sorts of events give people a reason to connect with our community and see us as part of the broader Australian, you know, network of people.
And obviously events have taken on a very different nature in 2020. Sarah, I want to hear a little bit how you have found the role of president this year and the sort of particular challenges of 2020 and issues that the Muslim Legal Network has had to deal with, like so many organisations with a lot of law changes and public health orders and a lot of new information coming in all the time. How has the role been for you this year?
When COVID all started, we had to make a big decision of whether we actually continue with running our annual iftar dinner. Advertisements were out, tickets started to sell, and we had to pay a deposit on the venue. So making that big decision of when everybody was in the unknown, that do we hold an event, what are the risks? So as a group and as a team, we had to throw up the pros and cons and make a decision that we're going to cancel the event for this year. And that, as you've mentioned, updating people both in the community and our profession of the day-to-day changes in the law. So creating leaflets and, as Zahira mentioned earlier, doing Facebook Live events and doing regular Zoom meetings. Mental health for everybody, where everybody was now at home or in unusual environments and isolated. So trying to engage each other and engage people of the community and how you're going to address. You can't hold social events. You can't really have face-to-face meetings. So, yeah, it was a bit of that. So, and we managed. Zahira's a bit of our tech head in our group. Then, as Zahira mentioned, we did an Q&A session. So it was informative for students who now were, their whole learning was based online, and they were going through the preparation of grad roles and interviews. And so it was sort of trying to fill gaps, I guess, both for different age groups and people in different stages of their profession and just life generally, I guess.
And you obviously both, you were talking earlier that you both sort of graduated into that the time of the GFC. So I imagine also you're well placed to assist with graduates now who are now the current crop of graduates are now also facing graduating into a completely unprecedented time and a time with a lot of uncertainty. So I imagine that you both also have an experience of the time that you entered the profession as well to impart guidance on the budding young lawyers of 2020.
Yeah, I don't know if they want to listen to my advice, but look, I think one thing we did do, and we just had a meeting on the weekend actually, is we've recognised that exact thing actually, as you've just articulated, and what we're going to do is set up some various panel discussions for students in the coming weeks and the coming months. And we're also starting a new initiative which has temporarily been given the name Duty Mentor. What we basically will give students who are really struggling in this time to know what to do. Like, there are law firms they don't have careers fairs, you know, you can't go to uni, all of this sort of stuff. So what we've offered is for our members and even non-members, if you have a question, one of our broader mentor team will just get back to you. So it's, you know, it doesn't have to be necessarily formal. And I think we have to be adaptable in this day and age to be able to say, hey, if there's a student who can't get in contact with us or they need to speak to us at a particular time, they can just email, you know, our mentoring line and we'll get back to them and sit down and have a chat and see what we can do for them. But I think you're right. I mean, everyone's using this word unprecedented, and it's true. We're living in a very strange environment, and jobs are scarce, but then also some opportunities are rising. So we just sort of need to, you know, maybe not send everyone down to insolvency law, but which is quite busy at the moment, but, you know, try and give our best descriptors of how to survive this as a student or as a grad.
I think even generally, I think if the more senior professionals are available and just reach out, I find if you do that sort of regularly, it just gives the mentee or the student a little bit more encouragement. One of the issues that students or someone starting out in law find difficult is that there's this constant pressure, and grad roles are constantly advertised and they're out there. There's much more in law to do than just a grad role or going to a top tier firm. You can be a tutor, you can teach, you can work with a barrister, chambers clerk. There's a lot of other avenues that people can take, and it's just a matter of them not exploring those ideas or not knowing about them. So I think the more we talk and discuss, it's great.
what I wanted to sort of finish up with is talking about, trying to have a little bit of a lighter end to talking about 2020 and the unprecedented challenges. And obviously most people have been working from home and doing things online and sort of finding new activities and hobbies. Is there anything that you have picked up as a new hobby or a new vice or a new interest in 2020 that you're willing to share with?
I think everyone became a chef, that's yeah. for sure.
Yeah, that's right. Everyone did. I'm really bad. I'm like that kid who has a million hobbies, and being at home made it even worse. So my wife's probably wants to kill me. I've actually taken up bike building, which is a very obscure sounding thing. So
you are crazy.
So I rebuild just as a hobby, like bicycles. So one of the things I started doing is I bought an airbrush kit. So I'm now trying to flex my arty side of my brain, so it's not purely mechanical. But yeah, I think something to keep me, you know, away from trouble and at home as much as I can. We, you know, trying to avoid going out too much. Yeah, bit of art and a bit of art and craft. I think that's the best way to describe my hobbies: arts and crafts.
I actually did more gardening, as boring as it sounds, but it was quite cool. Veggie patch, and yeah, did a lot of things around the house outside, got a bit of sun. And yeah, other than that, once gyms reopened, I tried to get back into a routine. Yeah.
Did you do the fitness apps?
No, I didn't.
They
yeah.
were terrible.
I wasn't keen on that.
I did two Les Mills step classes in front of my TV, and then when my wife started taking photos of me and sending it to her friends, I stopped. So yeah, I think I did it once or twice and gave up. They're good, but, you know, I don't know. I think running around the block and not making a fool of myself that way is much better than doing it in my living room.
Well, Zahir and Sarah, thank you so much for taking part in LSJ Trust Chat. It was wonderful to speak to you both.
Thank you for having us, Amy.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to LSJ Just Chat. My guests today were Zahir Edries and Sarah Khan. Today's episode was hosted by me, Amy Dale. Just Chat is a production of the Law Society of New South Wales. It is recorded and produced by The Story Mill, with theme music by Books Kid. For more episodes, visit lsj.com.au.